Good evening. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. It's tape 452, August the 3rd, 1980, side 1. We've had some mechanical difficulties at KLRB in taking the tape directly off the air. We've tried to put the attachment into the tape cassette so that the tapes going out to you will be the ones that I do have on KLRB each week. But there were some mechanical problems this evening, as there were last week. So I came home from doing the hour at KLRB, and I'm going to make the cassette for you at this time. There are some advantages and disadvantages to sending these tapes out on the air. When I went off the air and started the newsletter by subscription on the cassettes, it was a much more personal affair, and I felt that the news rolled along faster and that I could get right into material quicker and speed it along. And some of you are very sharp, and you send me articles and books and material and understand completely what I'm saying. After being off of KLRB specifically for 2 years, there's quite a culture lag, and it's very hard to bring the people up to date. I feel like I'm almost talking down to the audience that's been taking the tapes continuously, trying to catch them up with terms and names that we use. It's going pretty well in terms of the local community accepting the material again. It's really great. So that you subscribers on the tape will have to bear with me as I repeat some material that you've had. I'm trying not to repeat information you've had while I'm giving them new information and filling the pieces. So there is that problem. Just bear with me a few weeks, and hopefully next week the cassette again will go back from what they get on the air here in KLRB. This is an election year, and I get many letters and calls about my opinion on the various candidates, whether it's Ronald Reagan or Jimmy Carter or whoever is going to be nominated in the Democratic Convention, which will be taking place shortly. I'll do maybe 1 hour in August on the best and the worst of Reagan. And also I'd like to do a hour tape, if possible, on the decline of Jimmy Carter. I started a file on Jimmy Carter January 1979 called Carter Going Down, similar to the way Richard Nixon was pulled out of office. The disarray of the Democratic Party is well orchestrated, not that they didn't fall for all of the tricks and contribute to their own decline by being surrounded with people who were going to bring the Carters down, introducing Rosalind Carter to these various people like John Gacy or Jim Jones and the Eppolito brothers and organized crime figures, and sending Billy Carter to Libya to meet with Gaddafi. I mentioned last week he isn't a world leader, and Robert Vesco met with two members of Congress in the Bahamas last week, and they were going down that Sunday, just the time I was doing the broadcast, and I said Billy Carter isn't an international figure. He isn't a wheeler dealer. He's never really gotten into this kind of thing. And the Carters are being set up. And then Monday's newspaper, just this Monday the 28th of July, Robert Vesco said, "I was just being used to bring down Billy Carter," when the congressmen from Arizona and Nevada, not Nevada, Utah, Orrin Hatch, went down to see Billy Carter's great pal, Robert Vesco. Vesco explained to them that he was doing this to embarrass the Carters, and the congressman came back and said, "Well, you can't believe what Vesco says. He's so slimy, that creepy little guy." In just about that many words, they shut up. But if Robert Vesco had given them a lot of dirt about Billy Carter, then he would have been brilliant and intelligent and very reliable. So that this last week they were quiet on the Carter affair, fairly quiet, but Billy and Jimmy Carter were swept more into the Libyan Gaddafi scandal, which surrounds Jimmy Carter at this time. So in the next few weeks, I'll do a couple of hours, in the next few months, a couple of hours on the demise, the political demise of the Carter family. Gerald Ford spoke at the Republican convention, and he was one of the primary speakers, and there was a paragraph in his speech. I don't know how many of you heard him or read it. It was reprinted in the New York Times, but there is this statement by Gerald Ford in quotes: "We are a peaceful nation because we are free, happy, and united people in a system that works, unlike the Soviet Union, which uses force to keep a death grip on its people. Ford continued, just look around the world at other nations. Assassins who get there by force. Despots who come to power by fear, not by free elections. Our leaders come from our people, a continuous constitutional line of men and women from the people, from places like Grand Rapids, Michigan, Plains, Georgia, and soon from Eureka, Illinois. Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission. He was a person that hid the conspiracy to murder the President of the United States, who was chosen by an election by the people. He didn't say, he didn't refer to New York City where Nelson Rockefeller was killed, or Los Angeles where Robert Kennedy was killed, or Dallas, Texas, John Kennedy. And he didn't talk about presidents coming from the people, such as from Whittier, California, climbing on the corpses of various persons in order to gain and obtain that White House prestige and power. He didn't refer to the murder at Chappaquiddick of the White House plumbers. Mary Jo Kopechne was murdered in order to keep Ted Kennedy from running for president in 1972, or the shootout in Laurel, Maryland, when the White House plumbers and the White House officials were begging George Wallace not to run and split the votes with him. They took him up in an airplane and had a long talk with him. And the eve of his primary in Michigan and Maryland, he was shot and crippled, and those conservative votes helped Richard Nixon's election. And Gerald Ford worked with Nazis, not neo-Nazis, with fascists. He worked with the intelligence community, the CIA, Navy intelligence, and he, of all people, should know that we do not have a continuous constitutional line of men and women from the people. The people have nothing to say about this. The candidates are selected by bullets and blackmail, and Gerald Ford should know that very well. I got an article from the New York Post from one of the subscribers to these tapes who listens and sends some fantastic articles, and it's a quotation of G. Robert Blakey. He was head of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. He is surfacing a little more. I criticized him a few weeks ago for traveling around with Anthony Summers, who wrote Conspiracy, and Blakey continuously cutting off the investigation of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King beyond whispering that was probably organized crime. But Blakey was quoted in the New York Post this last week. Blakey, in quotes, was critical of the Department of Justice, saying it deliberately delayed acoustic tests of tape recordings of the Kennedy shooting. I've talked with people in the Department of Justice, and they are postponing the acoustics as long as possible because they know how it is going to come out. There were two shooters. Blakey said the department is afraid to admit it was wrong in its determination in 1964 that only one assassin was involved. The House Select Committee on Assassinations has, in Volume 12, a list of a possible 24 suspected firing points in Dealey Plaza. If there was more than one gunman, and there were two or more, there's a suggestion of where they could have come from. The easternmost sixth-floor window, called the famous Oswald window, the roof of the Texas School Book Depository, the seventh floor of the depository, the fourth floor, the innermost window, the westernmost pair of sixth-floor windows, the other side from where Lee Harvey Oswald was, the roof, the Dow-Tex building, the second floor, the third floor, the upper floor of the Dow-Tex roof, the county records building, the county records second floor, the stockade fence on top of the grassy knoll, the cement retaining wall in front of the stockade fence, in front of the cement structure on the knoll, the railroad overpass, a storm drain at the north curve of Elm Street, the umbrella man with a weapon described in Senator Church's committee, the CIA described a weapon, fatal weapon, a gun concealed in an umbrella, and the south knoll, the grassy knoll on the south side of the plaza on Commerce Street. As I say, Volume 12, page 306 and 7, goes into the possibilities of where these shots came from based upon the positions of John Connally and John Kennedy and photographic evidence that was procured from various people in the Dealey Plaza area. Many were not called before the Warren Commission. The reason I go into Blakey's statement about more than one gunman and the positions that, where they could have fired from the grassy knoll is that the way this is accomplished is weapons with silencers. And silencers are made for the State Department and for the Central Intelligence Agency by Mitchell Werbel, who works with these assassination teams and whose name surfaced recently in the news with the arrest of Frank Turple, or Francis Turple, and George Corcola and Ed Wilson. The biggest story in the country I mentioned last week when I went back on KLRB was and is the arrest of Turple and Corcola. We've done many tapes, and you subscribers have the advantage of 5 or 6 or 7 tape cassettes on these characters. And when I'm talking on KLRB, it's hard to update them with this information because they don't have the back facts, and I don't like to repeat what you already have. The reason I feel it was so big is that the scandal of Billy Carter being in Libya and possibly selling a couple of airplanes to Gaddafi is nothing compared to the Central Intelligence Agency through Turple and Corcoran and Samuel Cummings in London of selling at least $2 million of weapons to the PLO, to another $2 million to Idi Amin, another $2 million to Gaddafi. This team of persons that are being exposed in a network that will be more prominent in the court trials to come up concerning their arrests, these people have funded the athletes, the killing of the Jewish athletes at the Munich Olympic Games, the FALN, the Alpha 66, the anti-Castro Cubans, just as I wrote, the SLA is the CIA. The terrorism that looked to be left has always been funded by the CIA, and this group are in the news now and will be in the news more as Billy Carter gets attached to the Libyan connections and Gaddafi. You'll hear more about Turple and Corcoran. As a matter of fact, in this Sunday's paper today in the Chicago Tribune is a picture of Billy Carter playing golf and an article by James Coates. As I say, it's from the Chicago Tribune. Congressional investigators have received Justice Department files suggesting that Billy Carter, the president of Jimmy Carter, the brother of the president, Jimmy Carter, was involved in a scheme to obtain machine guns for pro-terrorist Libyan government. The most bizarre side issue as yet to come out of this whole case centers, according to the Chicago Tribune, on Francis Turple, a former CIA agent and soldier of fortune who allegedly has run a global hit squad for Libya. The important thing about Turple and Corcola is that they're not former CIA agents, and Ed Wilson is not a former CIA agent. When men are arrested or caught, they become former. E. Howard Hunt and James McCord were part of the CIA. When they were arrested at Watergate or discovered at Watergate, they were described as being former agents. McCord Associates was a dummy front, still for the CIA. E. Howard Hunt got his photographs, his clothing, his safe houses, for burglarizing a psychiatrist's office in Beverly Hills from the CIA. These men got all of their agents, their plumbers, Frank Sturgis, Bernard Barker, Mr. Martinez. They all came from the CIA. The team were CIA operatives, but when they were arrested, they were described as former. There were two articles that I did describe last May on tape 442, May 23rd, from the New Jersey Courier-Post about Robert Vesco saying the FBI planned to kill me. And the FBI had a kidnap plot called Operation Kingfish, in which they were going to drug and kidnap Vesco because of his links to Jimmy Carter and his $10 million payoff or offer to the Carter administration in exchange for his not being brought to this country to stand trial, in spite of the fact that he could be very angry about the attempt to assassinate him, drug him, and kidnap him. He still had the guts enough to come out, as I say last week, and say that he was used to set up Billy Carter. But this latest story about Billy Carter being in Libya with Frank Turple gets the case even more complicated. And according to the Chicago Tribune, this story just started to surface last April. That isn't true. The Turple Corcoran Wilson story started to surface the first of this year, and the news media has had this deadly silence until they could bring in Billy Carter and Libyan connections. But it's interesting, the Justice Department has said, and a judge in Washington, D.C., have agreed that they're not going to do the trial against these men, Wilson and Turple, until November the 5th, the day after the presidential election. They said Turple is free on $100,000 bond. A Washington federal judge, because of publicity surrounding the president's brother, set a trial for November the 5th for Turple and Wilson. Now, they're being charged for a list of crimes. One is being a conspiracy to murder a Libyan defector who went to Egypt. The other was for transporting explosives abroad and acting also as unregistered agents. So a murder trial of a Libyan is being postponed in Washington, D.C. because of the publicity of Billy Carter. So I'm sure that at the time of the trial, Billy Carter may come out if his brother isn't nominated and tell more about this assassination team. And since their murder trial also, so they're going to wait and see who's nominated for President of the United States, and then the trial is put off until after the presidential elections, which is pretty cute. The name Wilson, Ed Wilson, is interesting because Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, who did so many stories on Watergate, picked up his name as being part of the team that killed Letelier and Sandra Moffat in Washington, D.C. Also, the Chicago Tribune story on Billy Carter and the Libya gun connection with Frank Turple leads out the important part of George Carcola, who has the New Jersey assassination teams, who trains assassins for all over the world. New Jersey, the home of I.G. Farben, of organized crime and the casino mob, of a lot of the Alpha 66, the most violent anti-Castro Cubans are in New Jersey. There were links of Jonestown to New Jersey. And the New Jersey connections are very important to the Washington, D.C. Samuel Cummings weapons procurer in London. And the story in the news of Billy Carter so far only rubs to Turple and not to Corcoran with the assassination teams. But the Washington Post picked up that they call him former CIA agent Edwin Wilson was suspected of having provided the detonator of the Letelier Moffat bomb. And information has come through the Justice Department and investigations that this Ed Wilson, who was active and worked with the Anti-Castro Cubans and the New Jersey assassination teams and with Mitchell Werbel and that weapons systems outfit, this same person who's linked to all of this is also linked to Turple in a court case of a murder and assassination in Washington, D.C. right now. Billy and Jimmy Carter have promised to tell all about the Libyan connections, but I'll bet you that national security will keep them from telling the whole truth. It's hard to fill in for the radio listeners all of the tapes we've done on conspiracies and the weapons systems from Zaharoff to Samuel Cummings in London and their links to Turple and Corcoran. In May of this year, 1980, on tape 441, I have mentioned a book called The Weapons Merchant by Bernd Engelmann, and it's about Samuel Cummings of the CIA and his Philadelphia connections and links to London and Monte Carlo, described in this book as the largest private arms dealer in the world who inherited the mantle of the sinister Sir Basil Zaharoff of Monte Carlo. I also have mentioned, going back to tape 435, April the 4th, the Philadelphia connections to assassinations and weapons, Tsarist terrorists, and going into the Monte Carlo connections, and again, Samuel Cummings, and the Philadelphia connections of Cummings, and the main line of Philadelphia to Grace, Princess Grace of Monaco, a Tsarist named Cummings, Catherwood, the Fox Munitions Corporation, George de Morenchel, Lee Harvey Oswald's closest friend, his Philadelphia connections, Ruth Payne, the woman that housed and kept Marina when She stayed with Lee while he went down to New Orleans to get housing. Frank Sturgis, the anti-Castro Cuban, Sylvia Odio. I did a tape on 20 Philadelphia connections to the John Kennedy assassination. Well, there was an item to follow this up, a fascinating item in the News Washington Post this last week by Maxine Cheshire, and she continuously puts out in her weekly columns bits and pieces of information that are little gems. And this last week she was describing the Republican convention and the social life and what Mrs. Reagan was wearing and what Elizabeth Taylor was wearing and Anna Chenault. Then she comes to a paragraph and she says, Senator John Towers' wife, sister of international arms merchant Sam Cummings, confirmed reports that her brother had recently been back in the United States. Cummings, a former CIA agent who now holds Irish citizenship and lives in Monaco while running his global Inter-Armco, was back in town for the first time in years, Mrs. Tower said, just about 2 months ago. Well, that was a nice little tidbit to pick up about Senator Tower's wife. Senator Tower is from Texas. And I went instantly to my Warren Commission hearings to get out the copy of the correspondence that Lee Harvey Oswald had with Senator Tower in San Antonio, Texas, in Washington, D.C., he wrote to him, rather, that he was ready to come home. He wrote to him from the Soviet Union, Dear Senator Tower, my name is Lee Harvey Oswald, and he tells that he's an American in Moscow and he wants to bring his Russian wife home. He wrote the letter to Tower in January of 1962. Oswald's letter was sent to the State Department, and the State Department replied to Senator Tower about the correspondence and that they would take care of it, and they suggested the state advised Senator Tower not to become involved in this case. And they wrote him a letter. Tower sent his letter, a copy of Oswald's letter to him, January 26, 1962, signed John Tower, and he said this inquiry should go to the executive branch. I don't know why it wouldn't go to the State Department. Lee Harvey Oswald, as I have said many times, was an agent of Navy intelligence. He was bringing home a white Russian czarist who was leaving the Soviet Union, who was brought up as a little princess, a spoiled brat, and he was transporting her to the United States under the guise of being his wife. They had a civil ceremony. And when he was ready to come home, he asked for his passport that was kept in the office of the American Embassy and money to come home and to bring her home. So he wrote to Senator Tower in January 1962. George de Morenschild, the fellow I referred to many times, Oswald's close friend, intelligence agent, pro-Nazi, worked with Nazis, worked with the intelligence community ever since he left Poland and his family had fled Russia. His father ran the Baku oil fields for the Nobel family, later hopefully taken over the oil contracts by Rockefeller. De Morenschild testified in Volume 9 of the Warren Commission hearings about Marina Oswald. He said, you know exactly the story of her life, that she comes from a family of ex-czarist officers. Her father had been a czarist officer of some kind. You see what I mean? I don't remember whether it was the Navy or the Army. I don't recall anymore. Her mother remarried, and he goes into the background. I don't remember what her father's profession was. Now, that was one of the deep, dark secrets of the Warren Commission, was the background of Marina Oswald. But I believe, because of the way the Russian community treated her in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, that she was related to one or more of those people there. Well, after Lee Harvey Oswald sent his letter to John Tower in January, then in March, the State Department pushed all waivers aside for Marina Oswald and sent a letter in view of the strong representation made by an appeal in the State Department of one member of the State Department of March 1962. You are hereby advised that sanctions imposed on of Immigration and Nationality Act are hereby waived in behalf of Mrs. Oswald. He sent the letter to Senator Tower in January 62. Tower sent it to the executive branch and by March, all conditions for her were waived. They also wrote in the Warren Commission, Volume 24, page 298, that there were sections there about a Russian person coming to the United States, a Section 212. Section 212 said that there had to be a file check on Marina Oswald by the CIA, the FBI, the Department Security Office, the Division of Biographical Intelligence, and the Passport Office. And all holds on Marina were taken off, and in quotes, the Warren Commission hearing said the procedure for handling eligibility is determined by the Attorney General, and it was relegated here that Marina Oswald should be allowed to come and that there would be a waiver of Sanction 243. At first, it was not authorized, according to the State Department documents. There was a refusal to pass a waiver on the Oswalds, but then they decided that they would pass it, that this was an extra special case, and they added that they should be on their way to the country as soon as possible. March 16th, the Soviet Affairs Office, that's the United States Embassy in the Soviet Union, of the State Department, advised the Visa Office that it is interest of the United States to get Lee Harvey Oswald and his family out of the Soviet Union and on their way to this country as soon as possible. Now, it seems that Senator Tower's name came in the news media immediately after the assassination of John Kennedy, and there's a comment here, an exhibit, talking about the matter that concerns Lee Harvey Oswald after the assassination for the purpose of clearing wild charges made in the foreign and domestic press to the effect that Senator Tower facilitated Oswald's repatriation and coming back to the United States. So evidently, right after the assassination, there was information in the news media about Lee Harvey Oswald approaching Senator John Tower to get Marina and himself home. I think that the assassination of John Kennedy was set up as soon as Richard Nixon lost the election to John Kennedy. Robert Mayhew had met with the assassination teams since the summer of 1960 and was setting up the potential to kill not only Fidel Castro, but to kill John Kennedy. John Rosselli and Carlos Barcellos, organized crime, were making their blending with the intelligence community and the assassination squads. And the cover for these assassinations, I'm sure if they were planned as early as 60-61, would be perfect to use a man like Lee Harvey Oswald, bringing his czarist wife to the United States and her testifying and claiming Oswald was guilty, he was the lone nut, covering the real conspirators and the people behind the assassination. They were to be used to cover the crime of assassination, not for the shooting, but to give in their set of personalities and the lies that were fabricated about them, it would be believable that Lee Harvey Oswald could have shot the president. I think the link of John Tower and his sister to Samuel Cummings, Mitchell Werbel, and the assassination teams in Washington, D.C., and in New Jersey is fascinating, and in Pennsylvania, that his wife is a person from the main line in Philadelphia whose brother handles these assassination weapons and sells them all over the world and kills heads of states all over the world and sets up coups and counter-revolutions and terrorism. The fact that the wife of Senator John Tower is the sister of Samuel Cummings is a point that has many, many implications, and I'm dwelling on this because those of you that have studied the assassination know what I mean. There's another sideline to the story of Tower because I hadn't looked up this testimony. Maybe it's been 10 years since I went through every word of the Warren Commission hearing. So much has happened since I read and cross-filed that material, that when I looked up the correspondence of Tower, I read that his secretary, the woman in the Senate office in charge of his affairs, is Miss Linda Lee Lovelady. Now, that's a very unusual name because there was a gentleman, Billy Nolan Lovelady, who was a dead ringer for Lee Harvey Oswald, who was standing at the doorway the day that John Kennedy was killed. His wife's name is Patricia Lovelady, but I don't know if he has a sister that worked for Senator Tower or not. Most of the witnesses, the 552 witnesses that talked before the Warren Commission and were called to testify, gave their name, their address, the name of their wife and their siblings, and got into their background before they gave their testimony under oath, whatever it's worth. But Billy Lovelady is this controversial person that was suspected of being a double Lee Harvey Oswald, and that name is so unusual that I wondered if the secretary working for John Tower in Washington, D.C., was related to the Lovelady who was at the Texas School Book Depository where Lee Harvey Oswald worked. On the other part of this tape, I'll do a little bit more about Lovelady before we go on to some of the other material.